And what about the brother of Count Volkov? He was my enemy. I had other matters to attend to. Well, hey folks, how you doing? I'm Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, and you've tuned in to the Mystery Hour, right here on Sun's Hounds of Arizona. A joy to have you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and James Tipton bring us our first story. It's called The Blue Palace. In June of 78, I was free. I had passed my last medical examination. As fate would have it, though my father was lying ill in Edinburgh, and no knowledge or new degree of mine could further his stay in this world. On the 18th of June, the anniversary of Waterloo, I remembered ironically, I received the telegram from my mother and I caught the night train from King's Cross. The next morning, I walked up the stair of our old family home and recalled hearing my father's steps every night, returning home. There was something so reassuring about the regularity and the sturdiness of his steps. The familiar oaken door was opened by Robert, the aged butler whom I thought had been old when I was young. I followed his somewhat bent figure into the morning room where my mother looked up from her embroidery. I kissed her cheek and noticed her tired but still clear blue eyes. She managed a smile and said, "I'm so glad you're here, John. Your father has been saying your name. I think there is something he wants to tell you. Why don't you go up right away?" I had pictured a different reunion with congratulations for my degree, but there were more pressing matters. "I'll have cook send up some tea and biscuits," she said as I started up the stairs. And for that, with my long journey, I was very grateful. The first thing I did in the sick room was to open a window. It was June, after all, even in Scotland, and there were green leaves on the rowan trees outside the window. I sat by my father's bed and sipped my tea. I thought he was asleep, then his eyes fluttered open. Their deep brown seemed a bit watery or vague, but he spoke out in a hoarse voice. "So there you are. I was wondering if London had eaten you up. Scotland's where you belong, me son." I wondered if he would like to hear of my completing medical school. "I'm a doc," I started to say. "You know, Tennyson had it right, my boy." He spoke slowly and with effort, and I had to strain to catch all the words. But I was curious now. My father had been in charge of the Light Brigade, the one made famous by Tennyson's poem. And my father was one who made it back from the mouth of hell. One of the ones who was left. He never talked about it, and I always thought it intrusive to ask, although it was part of family lore. He had got the appropriate medals and was honored sometimes at dinners of old soldiers. Was he finally going to tell me about it? I knew it had haunted him. He said he hated the poem. Now, I found out that probably long ago he had memorized it. "Cannon to right of them," he said and paused. "You know how it goes, so does every schoolboy. The jaws of death, cannon to left and behind them, rhyming thundered and blundered. What everyone forgets is that we plunged in the battery smoke, right through the line they broke, Cossack and Russian, reeled from the saber stroke." They always forget we got there, and Tennyson doesn't mention that every one of us thought, "Where's the heavy cavalry that's supposed to come behind? How could they just leave us there? It was the ride back that finished most of them." He paused again. So now he was finally telling me what it was like. I waited. "But that's not what I want to tell you about. I want to tell you about the letter. I was wondering about the possibility of delirium now. From the charge of the Light Brigade to a letter was a bit of a leap. He lifted a big hand from the covers and waved it slightly in the direction of his bureau. "Third drawer, on the left, at the bottom of all the papers. Bring it." Was this a letter from some lost love before he knew my mother? Was it right for me to see it? But I obeyed him, sifted through the papers to the bottom of the drawer, and was intrigued to find indeed a folded, faded letter. It even had brown marks that could be bloodstains. On the top was written, in a bold hand, "Count Volkov, St. Petersburg, La Russie." I brought the letter to my father. "You see," he said in a slow way, "I had to be patient. As Tennyson says, this man had reeled from the saber stroke, but it was my saber stroke. He knew he was dying, as I know now myself. Don't deny it with the medical knowledge I know you have. Well done, by the way, very, very well done. I hope you can join the medical corps of the Bengal Lancers, but that's another story." "Thank you," I managed to say. "You see, he had prepared this letter in the event of his death. He was an officer, and all cultured Russians speak French. Even among themselves. Poor mon frère," he whispered with his last breaths. "My horse had been shot out from under me, and I broke my right arm in the fall. We were side by side in the muck of bodies and men and horses. He shoved the letter at me. 'Poor mon frère,' he reported. 'D'accord, d'accord.' I nodded and said, 'D'accord.' But, John, I never delivered the letter. I slipped it in my tunic, took the reins of a loose horse with my left hand, and made it back from the mouth of hell. I was one of the lucky ones. Why me?" I often thought. But mine was not to reason why. It was... well, if it was all the will of fate or the Almighty, it was not mine to question. But I felt bad, John. I felt bad when I had been lauded at silly dinners about... what about the others? And what about the brother of Count Volkov? He was my enemy. I had other matters to attend to. Then I had a family to raise. It wasn't my place to go gallivanting off to St. Petersburg with a long-lost letter." He paused again and seemed tremendously tired. The word gallivanting had taken him a long time, but I knew it was the word he wanted. "So I want you, John. This has haunted me. Not just the battle, but more so the letter. I had given my word, my d'accord, and had done nothing. Now will you please go to St. Petersburg? You've finished your studies. You deserve a change of scenery, what?" And he chuckled a hoarse chuckle that sounded more like a cough. "An adventure for a young man. It may lead to nothing, but at least you will have fulfilled your father's obligation. D'accord?" What could I say? "D'accord," I said. "Go now," he said. "Don't worry about me, for goodness sake. Worry about getting that letter to its rightful owner. Off you go, then." As I left the sick room, my father raised his hand again, this time all the way to his forehead, and saluted me. I saluted back. I went slowly down the stairs that I had hopped down as a boy. I knew that I had another reason to go. My own absurd, selfish, romantic reason. Countess Volkov was Maria Ferguson's new name now. The sweetheart of my youth. I had met her again in the gold fields of California when I played truant from medical school for a season. She said she and her husband, the Count, were going to return to St. Petersburg and, with their California gold, pay off his father's debts. Was her father-in-law, the Count, addressed in the letter? Was this the direction in which destiny was directing me? A dying father's wish as moral imperative to justify romantic curiosity? For I did not expect or even want any romantic involvement. Maria had her own life as a countess with a palace on the Fontanka Canal. Yet it was impossible to ignore this summons of the fates. So it was to the Fontanka Canal that I headed, with a combination of trepidation, excitement, and curiosity. It was one of those pastel-colored mansions that overlooked the canal. This one was a light blue. I'm afraid it reminded me of Mariah's eyes. It hadn't been difficult to ascertain the whereabouts of Count Volkov's residence. Now all I had to do was deliver the letter, even if just to the butler. Say hello, perhaps have some tea and a walk on the sunshine with Mariah, as an old chum from school days, and return to England to start my medical career. Maybe join the medical corps, as my father suggested. My sense of ease and excitement dropped, however, when I noticed black curtains drawn in the front window and a black wreath on the door. Family butlers must be the same the world over, but this one seemed, in the circumstances, especially ancient and lugubrious. He was very tall and thin and stiff to the breaking point. He looked at the letter I handed him with suspicion. "Whom did you say it was for?" he said in French. "The Count," I said. "It's on the address." "I can see that which count, sir."
"Whichever one can receive it. I am sorry for intruding. Please just pass it on to whomever it might concern. The letter is not from me."
"I can see that. I asked which count because one died a year ago, and his son died, well, not long ago." "Oh, no," I thought, "not Mariah's husband." "I can give it to his younger brother," the butler said. Then I heard a flute-like voice from the hall and some rustling of silks. "Who is it, Joseph?"
"It's an Englishman, milady."
"An English?" And there she was at the door, a black gown and blue agate eyes. "Good heavens, Hamish," she said in English. "What are you doing here? Did you—" "I'm sorry for your loss. I assure you I came only to deliver a letter from my father, not to intrude." Mariah lifted the letter from the butler's hands. "From your father? To the old count? And now—" "You better come in, Hamish. Joseph, bring our guests some tea, and will rye bread and jam do for now? Cook's rather pressed with the dinner this evening." "More than it is necessary, I assure you." I have followed her into the hall with gilt mirrors and into a dressing room with velvet curtains drawn in mourning against the summer sun on the canal. "I'll give this to Nicky," Mariah said. "He'll know what to do, and he's the count now." I'm so relieved, I thought. "Oh, I'm sorry. I called myself Countess in California and even Scotland to turn a few heads, but it was really Nicky's older brother who was the count. But now he's been murdered, or so they say. Dreadful business. Makes me want to return to Scotland. Nothing ever happens there." Joseph brought in the tea. I spread jam on the bread in silence. This was all so strange and a bit awkward. I thought I should leave. My mission was accomplished. "I won't trouble you or your family any more," I said. "I'll get the evening train." "Nonsense, Hamish." It sounded so good to hear her address me in the old playful way, by my middle name. "You don't know how good it is to see a face from home. It's been 2 months now since his brother's death, and Nicky thought it would be good to continue the tradition of the midsummer, the solstice, ball, to show the world that the Volkovs go on. You must stay here. We have loads of unused rooms." I started a protest. "A medical student? You can't afford a hotel. Or have you finished?" She saw me nod. "Oh, Hamish, good show. Look, we need to change the mood in this house. We'll raise a toast to you. Nicky's having a few guests over tonight, his regular dinner and card-playing friends, and the ball's tomorrow night. We'll take down the black curtains and wreath,
from a funeral to a ball. Rather ironic, but that's Russia. Deaths come and go, and lives go on. Russians see death more as a part of life than the British. We pretend that it really doesn't exist and are rather shocked when we find out that it does. Russians know its presence. It's always there. How did it happen? Have they caught the culprit? Are they sure it was murder? Well, Nikki's brother was found face down floating in the canal, and we thought at first he had drunk too much and fallen in. He did drink. But like most of his class, he could hold his liquor. Then they found he had been poisoned. So if it was an anarchist, it was one who had access to our kitchen. There's an anarchist in every pantry in Petersburg, they say. There had been dinner and cards that night. Always cards, Hamish. Oh, I'm sick of them. It was cards that drove Nikki and me halfway around the world to try gold mining. By the way, thank you again for all you did. Oh, it was nothing, I said. Few things have given me more pleasure than to pass on to Nikki that share in the mine. Well, it saved us and enabled us to come home. But Russia is in such unrest. Tsar Alexander had made so many changes to help the people, but no one is happy. Some say he is being too lenient. He freed some serfs from... He freed the serfs, for goodness sake. And others say he's not progressive enough. Some say all aristocrats are guilty. I'll go back to California. No one cares there who you are. You were quite successful as the Russian countess. Americans are rather in awe of aristocracy. But you haven't said if they found who did it. No, still looking. Need Scotland Yard. Sometimes they arrest or hang an arbitrary intellectual. I wouldn't frequent a coffee shop, even if a countess could. She paused. Say, Hamish, do you think we could look at that letter? It's not as though it's for anyone alive, is it? And I am the countess. I shrugged. Well, it's up to you. She leaned over and poured the tea from the tall silver samovar, and it fell in a long liquid tail. I breathed in her perfume, one I didn't recognize, and the scent of her hair, and it almost mesmerized me. She had the letter on her lap now. What's so important about the letter from 25 years ago, she said. Well, I think my father just felt obligated to follow through. Oh, listen to this, Hamish. It's a confession letter, a letter from a guilty conscience. Oh my, the younger brother, the one killed in the Crimea, stole all the money from a year's shipment of sugar. Nikki's family was big in sugar trade from the West Indies, but the sugar market collapsed during the Crimean conflict. We thought Nikki's father was strapped because of that, and then he gambled away the rest trying to get his money back. But listen to this. His brother hid it under a stone beneath the horse tamer's statue by the Anchinov Bridge. That's just down the canal. How could he do that? Lift a stone? How could we check? Could Nikki get permission to dig up a stone by a busy bridge? Would the money still be there? Oh, Hamish, this is exciting. And it could help, certainly, Nikki's finances. All that gold mine money we spent paying off debts and doing some of the needed repairs on the old monstrosity of a palace. Oh, Hamish, I can't wait to tell Nikki. The seal was unbroken. Your father had never read the letter. He never knew. An old obligation was good enough for him, but he must have intuited how important it was from the Russian officer's insistence. Dinner tonight, Hamish. I'll tell Nikki beforehand, and we'll have two reasons to celebrate and change the mood of this sorrowful house. You becoming Dr. Watson, and Nikki finding he has inherited a small fortune of sugar money instead of more debts. Mariah introduced me to the dinner guest, says Dr. J. Hamish Watson, and I must confess the title both amused and delighted me. After a toast to me, the toasts and the conversation turned to the more interesting topic of the treasure. That's what they were calling it now, I had just, I thought, got the names. Mariah told me something of their backgrounds. They were all speaking French, and although I couldn't speak it much, I could understand most of it. I looked at Nikki and Mariah sitting across from each other, occasionally catching the other's eye. Had I ever seen a more handsome couple? Through a lengthy dinner of potato salad with mayonnaise, beets, pickles, and pieces of meat, accompanied by rye bread, then borscht with sour cream, followed by a meat stew with onions and carrots and a side dish of buckwheat porridge, I listened to them and said little. Even if my French were up to snuff, the dinner kept me busy. Nikki's university friend, Anton, I had got the Christian names and immediately forgotten the surnames, was doing postgraduate studies in philosophy and was from an old aristocratic family. He could get the permission to dig up the stone. For this, he said jokingly, he would not require a share in the treasure. Nikki's friend, Vladimir, from the growing economic circles of Petersburg, that is, the son of the head of the Petersburg-Moscow Railway, and Nikki's brother, had been too liberal, too supportive of the changes Alexander II, the so-called liberator, had made. He hoped that Nikki, as the new count, would be more one of us, which I thought was ironic because Vladimir himself, coming from a background of trade, was clearly not born one of them, of the upper class. Vladimir snorted as he said, "And this liberator is about to sign a document for a constitution with two houses and elected officials." "What's wrong with that?" I ventured to say. "Britain has that, and it has worked quite well for centuries. So has America." "But this is Russia," Vladimir said. "We should all reread Rousseau," said Anton. "Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains." The beautiful blonde, high-cheekboned ballerina, Tanya, said, "Maybe, Joseph, the old butler knows all about the treasure. Why don't we ask him?" Old Joseph was duly summoned, and, amid wine glasses catching the flames of the sun that did not die in June, the curtains now having been raised, Joseph surprisingly announced that the old Tsar Nicholas had not died from typhus in Yalta, or wherever, he said, but had acquired a distaste, he said, perhaps from guilt, and that was not for him to say, for all things connected to power and politics, and had faked his death and retired to a cave on the island in Lake Ladoga, and had been regarded by the locals as a saint. At this there was some thunderous laughter. I indeed thought Joseph had grown a bit senile, for his comment was such a non sequitur. But Mariah, of all people, defended him. "Well, Joseph is quite right, you know," she said. "Even I, as a foreigner, have heard the rumor. My only question, dear Joseph, is what bearing this clandestine requirement of the old Tsar has to do with the letter that Dr. Watson delivered, intact from the Crimean War?" "It's quite simple, m'lady," Joseph said, his dignity never having wavered during the laughter in its thinly disguised ridicule. "The Count's younger brother, the soldier, had hidden the money to help with the cause of reinstating Tsar Nicholas, of bringing him back from Ladoga." Everyone was silent for a moment. This made some sort of conspiracy sense. In a country that thrived on plots and assassinations, attempted or otherwise, then Vladimir laughed. "Well, that would have been better than the two Alexander Tsars we've had since then. Total disasters, both of them." "Were you in agreement with the Count regarding this case?" Mariah said. "I couldn't say, but I can say, even though Nicholas is long gone, there are those in certain political factions in this city that would like to get their hands on that money that was meant for him. I think the Volia movement would like to get its hands on that treasure and make a few changes," Vladimir said. At the mention of the Volia movement, the table grew silent again. It was known for its assassination attempts on many aristocrats, but especially the Tsar. "We'll keep it for ourselves and go to the South Seas, won't we, Nicky?" Mariah said, and lightened the mood. "You may be dismissed, Joseph. Thank you for the interesting insight on history. The tea now, please, and the pastries." Joseph left with great dignity. Tanya said, "You see, I knew the butler knew something." It was the White Knights. When Vladimir brought up cards, he was scoffed at. It was twilight all night, and the other guests insisted on strolling by the canal at midnight. Anton wanted to dig up the treasure then and there, get some peasants with picks and shovels. But Vladimir said peasants with picks could be a trouble at midnight. Tanya pirouetted on the edge of the canal, and after what people had drunk at dinner, I was prepared to jump in and save her if she fell. But she teetered on her toes perfectly and fell gracefully into Anton's arms. "The White Knights," he said, "always something mysterious and wonderful during the White Knights." The Midsummer Ball was the next night, and I wondered what it would entail. Would they have the treasures by then? I wanted them to find it for Mariah's sake. Would they have found the killer and the reason behind the Count's death? Part of me wanted out of all of this and to be home in peaceful England. Things seemed ready to explode here. If someone was targeting the aristocracy, I didn't want Nicky to be next. While I was thinking of England, Mariah put her arm through mine. Nicky was laughing about something with Anton. "Oh, you know Anton, of all upper-class people," Mariah whispered, "goes to coffee houses and was seen with that known anarchist Vladimir Lenin, who said to have a younger brother who's more crazy than he is. Tanya is Anton's lover and is sympathetic to the anarchists. How about some haggis and McEwen's ale by a peat fire in a cottage in the Highlands? Doesn't that sound divine right now, Hamish? No intrigues, no murder of one's brother-in-law, no old treasures under a statue of a horse tamer. Of all things, what do you say, Hamish?" "I say the White Knights go to everyone's brain, and that the sunset that lasts all night, with its colors on the water, is, as you said in California, worth traveling to see." I smelled her perfume again and felt her lean against me, her hair brush my cheek. "Oh, Hamish," she said. We walked that way quietly behind the others in their hilarity. It wasn't far to the Blue Palace on the canal. She leaned further into me and rested her cheek on my lapel now. I had wanted for years to have this moment, and it was going to be over in a minute. I didn't want to move. I didn't want to be any other place. It would be fine with me if she would come to a stop right here and now, and then we were at the white steps of the Blue House. Nicky stood before the door, raised an invisible glass, and said, "To Alexander II, the Liberator." Vladimir muttered something that sounded bitter. Anton laughed. Tanya threw back her head of yellow hair. Mariah and I had arrived now, and I answered with, "To Her Majesty Victoria Regina, Queen of England, Ireland, Wales, and Empress of India." I realized that I left out Scotland. The others had their arms around each other as Joseph opened the door to the palace of Count and Countess Volkov, and I felt Mariah disengage herself and enter her realm. I was wearing Nicky's black tie and tails, and it was a bit of a tight fit. By the time I strolled down the marble stairs, my hand was on the shiny mahogany banister. I could hear the orchestra playing a waltz. The colored gowns of the ladies and the black and white evening dress of the gentlemen swirled below me, and I thought I had never seen such elegance. And then I realized I hadn't, coming as I did from humble origins. And there was Mariah, her black hair piled high on her head and crowned with a tiara. Her gown was light blue. The sound of silks and heels on polished parquet floor moved like an ever-present stream beneath the music from the far room. Then Mariah lifted her eyes to me. She had on some necklace that shone and white gloves to her elbows. I felt I ought to kneel, but she smiled, and instead I smiled back. It was all beautiful. It was all perfect. And I had felt inconsolable when I realized I had lost her. I hadn't got over it when I met her in the magic of her smoky corner in the saloon in Nevada City, and now it was over, and she was smiling at me in her palace, and my own life, of which she didn't have any part, was just beginning. I saw Anton and Tanya move into the ballroom, his hand at the small of her narrow back. Anton had been upset today that they could not dig up the stone underneath the horse tamer's statue yet. He said time was not on the side of Alexander, if that had anything to do with it. Then he said the treasure was for the people, since it had been under this street for so long. If an agent of the Tsar had been near, he would have been arrested. But there he was, hair pomaded, entering into the realm of the waltz. Then Vladimir came in the door and patted old Joseph on the back. I was still rooted to the stairs. Mariah greeted Vladimir with a kiss on both cheeks. Then things moved very fast. Vladimir took something from his pocket and rolled it into the ballroom. "An imperial egg!" he shouted. It looked beautiful, gold with gems on it. But I moved fast, too. People were standing above the rolling golden egg. One bent down to look at it more closely. Vladimir shouted, "A gift from the Tsar!" And more people gathered round the egg. By the time I had reached the egg, a little circle of shining floor around it, and picked it up and ran to the door. "Thief!" shouted Vladimir. "He's stealing the egg!" "Open!" I shouted in French to Joseph, who, to his lasting credit, opened the door to me. I ran the few steps to the canal and threw the egg in. By now the men had gathered around me. They had me strongly by both arms. "He is crazy! He had a knife! Anarchist!" They wrestled me to the ground, and I hit my head hard on the pavement. Then we heard a sound like a crack of thunder, or several cracks of thunder at the same time. Water spurted up all around me. Then I heard cracking, a falling of stone on stone. With my face still on the pavement, I heard Vladimir's voice yelling, "Death to peasant lovers, to Alexander lovers!" and the sound receding down the canal. Then they pushed my head against the pavement again, and I didn't hear or see anything. I felt myself being lifted up. Everything seemed clear now, but different. "How did you know it was a bomb?" a woman said. I didn't know why she was speaking French. With an effort, I have changed into my traveling clothes. Mariah is in dark blue, or is it the same dress but the room is dark? The only light is the midnight glow of twilight through the window of a small salon. Mariah pours me tea again from the silver samovar. I watch its steam rise in the twilight. I appreciate its smoky aroma. I can hear distant waltz music. The party has resumed. In answering her question, I say, I finally realize what Vladimir said last night when Nikki gave his pretend toast to Alexander the Liberator. But my voice is far away. It is as if out in front of me. It's hardly me talking, but I listen to myself. It was, "Tu est bitte?" I say. Just that. It came back to me last night as I was lying in bed. I was almost asleep, and the thought startled me. It woke me up, and it took me a long time to go to sleep then. I thought this wasn't very important. I had to say the important things. Saying Nikki was stupid for praising Alexander, seeming harmless, but it was the way Vladimir said it. It was as if he were spitting the words. Then I remembered what he said at dinner about Alexander the First and the Second, both having been disasters, and how much he was against Russia, having a constitution and elected officials. You see, it wasn't the Volia movement at all, and not the intellectual, the coffeehouse-going Anton who lent an ear to the anarchists. It was the reactionary, that hated peasants and anyone who gave them rights. Killing the supporters of Alexander was his step toward killing the Tsar himself. It takes a lot for me to say all that, and now I'm exhausted. I just want to get on my train and go home. So you think it was Vladimir who killed Nikki's brother? I do. My voice seems to echo in the quiet room. I take it he was at the dinner and the card playing that night? Mariah nodded. It would have been easy for him to poison the Count's drink. Just go to the sideboard and fill up his glass. So not the anarchists at all. The police will be most disappointed, and Vladimir got away. I'm sure he has many friends to hide him. I twirl my hat in my hands. I think I have to go. There's a night train at 1 a.m, and I don't want to get involved in questioning from the Imperial Police. You've already told me about the train, and Joseph is hailing you a cab, Hamish. That's not your old Scottish cap. No, I wear a bowler now. She leans over to my chair and speaks softly. Anyone a foot away wouldn't have heard. You've saved us again, Hamish, but this time it was more than a share in a gold mine. It was our lives. It was the life of Nikki and me and our unborn children, not to mention the lives of all the others in the ballroom. We're leaving too, Hamish. We've discussed it before, and I just am so unequivocally said to Nikki, back to America. Too much politics here, too much intrigue, too many unhappy people. I liked California. I like Sacramento. I like the sunshine, not just the eternal twilight reflecting on a canal. It's not her words. It's her closeness. She could be saying anything. I think my breath slows down to nil. I know we'll see each other again, she goes on. I don't know where or when. Perhaps when we're both old. Wouldn't that be a lark? I can't envision my life at this moment without you, but that's the way it will go. You're a free young man now, a doctor. The world lies before you, the treasure. You know, it was uncovered in the explosion. When you were unconscious on the ground, the horse tamer fell over. Right beneath his feet was a year's worth of sugar money. Even if it's 25 years old, it's still money. That's what we'll use to get out of here. I don't know what I'd say if Nikki walked in right now and found me speaking close like this. I'd probably just say, school day, chums. And it would be true, right? School day chums, forever. I already have my one valise, and she walks me to the front door, the guest just visible as swirling colors in the ballroom. Joseph bows slightly to me and opens the door. It's impossible, Hamish, but it's true. Look! I still haven't said anything for a long time. I still could be in shock from discovering a bomb, throwing it into a canal without being blown up myself and hitting my head on the pavement. It's a new moon, Hamish. Impossible to see with all the painted colors of the twilight sky at midnight. But there it is, as new and white and slender as a broken piece of shell on the beach at Oban. It's been there while everything was going on and no one noticed. I looked at her, and I looked at it. They both seem similar, and I don't know why. I still haven't said anything. She puts her finger and thumb on my lapel and pulls me down to her and kisses my cheek. Au revoir, she says. I'm not saying adieu. Au revoir, Dr. Watson. I step back. I step in the cab and look back. And she waves once, then stands there looking at the cab until we cross the bridge by the toppled horse tamer. All the way to the station, I watch the new moon following me. Alrighty then, I'm going to switch over now to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. This is a story by Eli Cranor, and it's called Mask Up. Fish's mask slipped down past his nose, and he yanked it up quick, brown eyes darting over the top of the blue polyester, casing the liquor store. There were two patrons in the vodka aisle and a girl behind the sheet of plexiglass working the register. Through the window, Dixon Street was dead, just like the guy from Maxine's tap room said it would be. Big white guy in a red cap with a pig on it telling Fish, "Everybody's up at the stadium watching the Hogs. Game should be over here in about, 30, maybe 45 minutes. It was a 30-hour drive from Portland, Oregon to Fayetteville, home of the University of Arkansas Razorbacks. Fish Nance didn't know anything about the Hogs. He hadn't come all the way to watch a college football game. He just wanted to get out of his studio apartment, have a drink in a real bar, maybe throw some darts. But the big guy in the hog hat had another plan. A darn good one, actually, and, well, Fish had been living off food stamps and ramen noodles for months, waiting on the politicians to quit arguing and send him that check for $2,000. Fish talked to the big guy at the bar long enough to tell him his name and how the last 6 months felt like the 2 years he'd done at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility on B&E charges. Couldn't even go outside in Portland without getting funny looks, not with all the protests going on. Fish had marched in the beginning. Seemed like the right thing to do, carrying around a piece of cardboard with "I will never understand, but I stand," written across it in black Sharpie night after night. But then he lost his job at the Dragonfly Coffee House, and it wasn't fun anymore because whatever was happening to him. So he called his cousin Clementine in Arkansas, told her he needed a change of scenery, needed to get the heck out of his apartment before he lost his mind. Clementine said things were different in the natural state. No lockdowns, no stay-at-home order. Fish said that if he hustled, he could make it by Saturday. Well, Fish, huh? That's short for something? The big guy, mid-30s with the Fu Manchu mustache and working man hands, had asked. Fish told him it was short for Fisher, but only his mother called him that. The guy said his mother called him all sorts of nasty things, but Fish could call him Saddler. Fish remembered the way the man had stared back at him after that line, like he wasn't sure what to make of the hipster-looking 20-something from Portland. Maybe sizing him up before he said, "Me and you, pard, we got one thing in common." The tips of his mustache turning up in a grin as he moved on to their theory he had about how the pandemic had opened up a new possibility for burglarizing, whispering over Fish's shoulder in the dim-lit bar. "See, you walk into a liquor store wearing gloves and a mask these days, and don't nobody think twice about it. Gives you time to case the place, set it up, so all you got to do is point your gun at the cashier, take the money from the register, and slip out through the front door right back into Dixon Street." Saddler kept looking out from under that hog hat at Fish, waiting to see if the kid got the picture. Old Fish got it, but the big guy spelled it out for him anyway, saying, "Well, we'd have to time it right. Wait till the game's over. All those half-drunk college kids coming down the street, every one of them wearing a mask." Fish had his mask on now, standing inside the liquor store, watching the couple from the vodka aisle walk out through the sliding glass doors, leaving him alone with the cashier. He exhaled, and the stench of stale beer filled his mask. He brought a hand up, moving it past the bulge in his sweater. The .22-caliber pistol Saddler had given him right after they'd left Maxine's, telling Fish he'd park his Bronco around the block, then come in when the coast was clear. Fish didn't get why he had to be the one with the gun. And that's what he told Sadler, the big man frowning as he wedged himself behind the wheel. You did time right. You know how it works. One guy holds the gun, the other grabs the money. Look at that cute little sweater and them tight sweatpants you got on. Where are you going to stick all that dough? Sadler reached into a passenger seat and brought up a puffy red jacket. Well, looks sort of like a marshmallow, but I can get all kinds of money in here, and there's going to be some money. Everybody goes in that liquor store before the game, getting stocked up for the tailgate. It had made enough sense for Fish to take the gun and walk into Dixon's Street Liquor. 6 months of lonely nights and ramen noodles behind him. It felt good to be out in the world again. So good, Fish's fingers started working their way around the pistol grip, thinking of what he'd do with his cut when the cowbell above the door rattled and Sadler walked in. Both hands shoved deep in the pockets of his puffy red jacket. The hog hat pulled down low over his eyes, nose exposed, mustache quivering as he winked at the girl manning the register. Fish said, "Where's your mask, man? You're supposed to..." "Thought about it long and hard, but just couldn't bring myself to wear one. Them chim diapers. Besides, I can't afford to get quarantined." "Quarantined?" Fish said, glancing at the girl behind the desk. "The heck you talking about? See, I ain't got no mask of my own, and..." "There's a whole stack of masks," Fish said, "on the table to the left of the door." "And how many people you think been coming in here touching that stack?" Sadler raised both eyebrows. "Way I figure it, I'm better off breathing fresh air. Now, let's cut the chit-chat and get down to business. Time's ticking." Fish watched Sadler pull back the left sleeve of his jacket to check the time, trying to remember if the big guy had had a mask on at Maxine's. No, he hadn't, but neither had Fish. What was he going to do, drink his IPA from a straw? 5 minutes, Fish guessed, maybe less, and the stadium would be empty. Dixon Street flooded with Razorback fans, and then what? If the dumbass redneck wasn't wearing a mask when they walked out of the liquor store, Fish thought, smirking as he stepped around the plexiglass, it'd be his face on the cameras. "Okay, you're right," Fish said and raised the pistol, leveling it out on the cashier. "Time is of the essence." The girl said, "What?" and saw the gun and raised both hands, slow eyes going to Sadler as he moved around behind her, saying to Fish, "Look at us putting our differences aside and coming together for the good of the whole. If them politicians up in D.C. took a page out of our book, the Big 1-9 would be a thing of the past." "The Big 1-9? Fish said to his new partner, then to the girl, "Go on, open the register. Keep your hands where I can see them." "COVID-19, Sadler said, flipping the clips on the black plastic drawer. "The Rona. Kung Flu, that's it. Whatever. Jeez, would you look at all that money? I told you." Sadler had the drawer out now, loose change spilling over the sides, so focused on the money he hadn't noticed the girl's left hand coming down, slipping under the register for her phone. But Fish did. His first instinct was to grab the gun and jab it in her face and say something mean. Nah, that wouldn't be cool. Let her call the cops, Fish thought, standing there watching the girl tap the 9 on the glass screen twice, picturing the police rolling up as they walked out the doors, going straight for the only dummy in Fayetteville not wearing a mask. The girl had the last number punched into the phone when Fish realized the flaw in his logic and turned the pistol on his partner. "I'm sorry, man, but I'm going to need you to take that jacket off." Sadler looked up from the money drawer and into the pistol barrel without flinching or looking surprised at all. Disappointed? Yeah, Maybe. Fish couldn't tell. I said, take the jacket off. Well, this right here, Sadler said, flicking all the money clips down before leaning around the girl and pushing the drawer back inside the register. This is what's wrong with our country. A crying shame. That's what it is. I really thought we were doing something, well, special. Two guys from different parts of America, different views on life, coming together in these difficult times. Could have been a start of something. The pistol barrel came down an inch, sagging along with Fish's heart. The ideals he had a month or so before, during the protests, watching all those people march around the Multnomah County Justice Center in search of a better way. And now, that's just what this maskless redneck was offering him, a chance to meet in the middle, a compromise. Okay, man, listen, Fish said, aiming the gun at the girl again. I'm sorry, but I'd feel better if I could hold on to some of the cash. You just pointed a gun at me, kid. My own darn gun. I shouldn't have done that. I don't know what got into me. It just... No, I get it. Everybody's on edge these days, Sadler said, digging in his jacket pockets. You want the money now? That's what you're saying? Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. Sadler shoved a fistful of bills into Fish's cardigan. Now, that ain't nowhere near half, but it's about all you can fit in that fancy sweater. Consider it a down payment. The dude was sincere. The wrinkles around his eyes going slack, a look of, well, complete trust, made Fish feel real bad about the way he'd acted earlier, stepping past his partner now, thinking maybe there was still a way they could pull this thing off, together. Here, Fish said, taking a mask from the little table beside the door. Just put this on, man. We've already had the money. Fish turned, mask in hand, and saw Sadler holding the girl's cell phone up and out, staring down at the screen as he whispered, "She called the cops, kid. She called the..." A siren yipped a couple of blocks over. Maybe less. A harsh sound against the silent street. Fish cupped both hands over his eyes and peered through the glass, spotting a pale blue glow growing brighter as the squad car blew through an intersection a quarter mile up the road, casting shadows on the crowd ahead of it. A horde of college kids dressed in red, hundreds of them so close Fish could hear their voices over the wailing siren. "We gotta go," Sadler said, and yanked Fish by the shoulder, pulling him back from the glass. "Don't run or nothing, just fall in line with the herd. Play it cool." Sadler turned and tossed the cell phone back to the girl, surprising Fish again, showing kindness in the midst of chaos, saying, "This ain't got nothing to do with you, hun. Remember that." Then spinning back for the door, getting far enough to trip the sensor, the two glass panels sliding open as Fish caught him by the arm and whispered, "Just put it on, man. Mask up." Dangling the mask out in front of the man's leathery face. The thin fabric catching the squad car's lights, spinning round and round as a frat boy walked past the liquor store doors, the rest of the crowd shuffling along behind him. Fish didn't notice. He still had both eyes on Sadler, the big guy shaking his head as he took one step back, his expression clear, without a mask to hide it, his unburdened lips moving, forming words Fish would remember for the rest of his life. "I'll take my chances, kid." And then he was gone, slipping free of Fish's hold, out through the sliding doors and into the swarming mass of bodies. Fish rushed after him, moving fast, the heat of the crowd pressing against his chest, making it hard to breathe. The mask was making it even worse, but he would not take it off. He couldn't. And Sadler was still right there, a couple of steps ahead. Broad shoulders wrapped in red, head down, walking slow. But then he stopped so fast, Fish had to step to the side to keep from running into him. The man's profile coming into view now, smooth, clean cheeks, and black glasses. glasses. The only similarity between the dumpy college student standing beside Fish and the man who'd said his name was Sadler, neither one was wearing a mask. Fish felt a hand take hold of his wrist and spun him around, expecting to see Sadler, his partner coming back for him. But instead he found a police officer with his chin pointed toward the radio on his shoulder, keeping his eyes on Fish as he said, "You talk to the girl yet, partner? The cashier at the liquor store?" A muffled voice crackled through the radio tiny speaker. "Yeah, sure did. She said the kid don't even look like he's from around here. Said he's wearing a..." The voice cut out as the world opened up around Fish. Hundreds of maskless faces illuminated in the blue lights flashing from the squad car, parked sideways on the curb. "Yeah, that's him," the officer said, reaching into the front pockets of Fish's cardigan, retrieving a small-caliber pistol and four wadded $5 bills. "Gotta be. He's the only kid on Dixon wearing a mask." Well, all right, friends, this is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, saying thank you for tuning in to the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'd ask you to join me again next time, if you would, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.